Albert Einstein said, "Everything that can be counted does not necessarily count. Everything that counts cannot necessarily be counted." And so it is with the work and dreams of a congregation. Although all our spiritual work is tremendously valuable and it counts greatly for those who benefit from it, it cannot be counted, at least not, you know, the fingers. However, the cash that you so generously are going about to offer can be counted, and it counts. The more cash we can count today, the more your congregation can serve and give hope and love to others in need. May the source of all bless your offering and multiply it. The offering will be now generously given and gratefully received.
Thank you.
Please join me in the responsive reading number 584, a network on mutuality. 584. We are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny.
Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere.
There are some things in our social system to which all of us ought to be maladjusted.
Hatred and bitterness can never cure the disease of fear. Only love can do that.
We must evolve for all human conflict a method which rejects revenge, aggression, and retaliation.
The foundation of such a method is love.
Before it is too late, we must narrow the gaping chasm between our proclamations of peace and our lowly deeds, which precipitate and perpetuate war.
One day we must come to see that peace is not merely a distant goal that we seek, but a means by which we arrive at that goal.
We must pursue peaceful ends through peaceful means.
We shall hew out of the mountain of despair a stone of hope.
Please join me in body or in spirit as we sing hymn number 95, There Is More Love Somewhere. To hate this hymn because I said, how it comes? Love is here already. Where should I look? Somewhere else. Until I realized that it was a Negro spiritual sung by the slaves, hoping for more love somewhere, more peace somewhere. So now I love it, and that's what I included today. I have been told that the two words, things that a minister can do to a congregation he or she serves are. Would anybody venture to say which these two are? This is not a quiz, it's just, you know, conversation. guidance, the two words things. Two words things that a minister can do to a congregation. What? Scolding. Close. Okay. The first word thing that I was told that I could do to Cambridge when I came to serve there was to lack the courage to use my prophetic voice to tell them the truth. In other words, to coat the pill, to be nice, you know. We Unitarian Universalists had this culture of niceness, but God forbid. So to lack the courage to be a prophetic voice was one of the worst things that I could do. And the second thing was not to love them. So remembering the importance of prophetic voice, courage, and love, I decided to honor precisely these qualities in Martin Luther King Jr. And what better way to do this, I thought, than by sharing excerpts from his collection of sermons contained in his classic book, Strength to Love. Do you know that book? Beautiful book. In the foreword, Coretta Martin's wife gives us an insight into his essential devotion to love and peace with these words. She says, "This book best explains the central element of Martin Luther King Jr.'s philosophy of nonviolence, his belief in a divine, loving presence that binds all life. This belief was the force behind all of my husband's quests to eliminate social evil. By tapping the transcendent moral ethic of love, we shall overcome these evils." Now, Martin Luther King Jr. preached from Baptist pulpits. Yet, there is a wealth of wisdom in his words applicable to our own Unitarian Universalist faith and to many of our congregations. I hope this is not one. Martin's prophetic voice shines in his sermon, A Thought Mind and a Tender Heart. There he asserts that a tough mind is characterized by incisive thinking, realistic appraisal, and decisive judgment. He adds, soft-mindedness invades religion. This is why religion has sometimes rejected new truth with a dogmatic passion. This has also led to a widespread belief that there is a conflict between science and religion. There may be a conflict between soft-minded religionists and thought-minded scientists, but not between science and religion. End of quote. Before I continue, I warn you that I did not dissect his language. I'm going to use it verbatim. Thus, I invite you to, with open minds and hearts, to listen to the depth and beauty of his words, and more importantly, to his messages, which we so need to hear. He says, "Science gives man knowledge, which is power. Religion gives man wisdom, which is control. Science deals mainly with facts. Religion deals mainly with values. Science keeps religion from sinking into the valley of irrationalism and paralyzing obscurantism. Religion prevents science from falling into the marsh of obsolete materialism and moral nihilism." According to Martin, soft-mindedness is one of the basic causes of race prejudice. Therefore, he admonishes his people, "Soft-minded acquiescence is cowardly. My friends, we cannot win the respect of the white people of the South or elsewhere if we are willing to trade the future of our children for our personal safety and comfort. I believe we cannot gain respect as a faith if we continue trading the spiritual Unitarian Universalist future of our children for our personal theological safety and comfort. In his sermon, Transform Nonconformists, he says, "The tendency of most is to adopt a view that is so ambiguous that it will include everything and so popular that it will include everybody." Sound familiar? To us, colleagues, he says, "We preachers have also been tempted by the enticing cult of conformity. Seduced by the success symbols of the world, we have measured our achievements by the size of our parsonages. We preach comforting sermons and avoid saying anything from our pulpit which might disturb the respectable views of the comfortable members of our congregations. This hour in history needs a dedicated circle of transformed nonconformists. Our planet teeters on the brink of atomic annihilation. Dangerous passion of pride, hatred, and selfishness are enthroned in our lives. Truth lies prostrate on the rock hills of nameless Calvaries, and men show reverence before false gods, gods of materialism. The saving of our world from pending doom will come not through the complacent adjustment of the conforming majority, but through the creative maladjustment of a nonconforming minority. Human salvation lies in the hands of the creative maladjusted." Do you agree? In the sermon on being a good neighbor, Martin argues that the universalism at the center of the Declaration of Independence has been shamefully negated by America's appalling tendency to substitute some for all. Numerous people in the North and South still believe that the affirmation, "all men are created equal," means all white men are created equal. And he asks, what are the devastating consequences of this narrow group-centered attitude? It means that one does not really mind what happens to the people outside this group. If an American is concerned only about his nation, he will not be concerned about the peoples of Asia, Africa, or South America. Is this not why nations engage in the madness of war without the slightest sense of penitence? It is not why the murder of a citizen of your own nation is a crime, but the murder of a citizen in war is an act of heroic virtue. And as a true prophet, he continues, "Millions of missionary dollars had gone to Africa from the hands of church people who will die a million deaths before they would permit a single African the privilege of worshiping in their congregations." Wait, could this apply to us also? How is that that we Unitarian Universalists, champions of social justice, have only a handful, if that, of members of color in the majority of our congregations? In his sermon, Love in Action, Martin Luther King Jr. uses Jesus as the central paradigm of congruency between words and deeds. He says, "Forgiveness is not an occasional act. It is a permanent attitude." This is important. Forgiveness is not an occasional act. It is a permanent attitude. The potential beauty of human life is constantly made ugly by man's ever-recurring song of retaliation. Now, noting that Jesus' disciples were conditioned to the talion law or the law of retribution, King says, "Yet Jesus taught them that only through a created love for their enemies could they be children of their Father in heaven, and also that love and forgiveness were absolute necessities for spiritual maturity." Yes, tremendously difficult. tremendously difficult to practice, but so true. Love and forgiveness are absolute necessities for spiritual maturity. For that maturity is so needed to deal with anger and revenge by turning them into compassion and peace. King affirmed that throughout history, great tragedies happened at the hands of men who were not necessarily bad, but misguided and misinformed. He said, Socrates was forced to drink hemlock not by demonic men, but by respectable citizens of Greece. The Christians who engaged in infamous persecution and shameful inquisitions were not evil men, but misguided men. The churchmen who felt that they had an edict from God to withstand the progress of science, whether in the form of a Copernican revolution or a Darwinian theory of natural selection, were not mischievous men, but misinformed men. Talking about how slavery became possible in this country, King observes, some men conveniently twisted the insights of religion, science, and philosophy to give sanction to the doctrine of white supremacy. Soon, this idea was embedded in every textbook and preached in practically every pulpit. It became a structured part of the culture. Men embraced this as the expression of a final truth. They sincerely came to believe that the Negro was inferior by nature and that slavery was ordained by God. In 1857, in the Dred Scott decision, the court affirmed that the Negro had no rights which the white man was bound to respect. The whole system of slavery was perpetuated by sincere, though spiritually ignorant, persons. His sermon, A Knock at Midnight, is a fantastic exegesis of the parable in Luke 11:5-6. There, a friend goes to the neighbor's house asking to borrow 3 loaves of bread so he can feed his guests who arrived late from his journey. Talking about some Negro churches that deny food to the midnight traveler of the parable, King says, they have developed a class system and boast of its dignity, its membership of professional people, and its exclusiveness. Again, sounds familiar? In such a church, the worship service is cold and meaningless, not here. The music dull and uninspiring, and the sermon little more than a homily on current events. If the pastor says too much about Jesus Christ, the members feel that he is robbing the pulpit of dignity. If the choir sings an extra-spiritual, the members claim an affront to their status. This type of church tragically fails to recognize that worship at its best is a social experience in which people from all levels of life come together to affirm their oneness and unity under God. And he concludes, if the church does not recapture its prophetic zeal, it will become an irrelevant social club without moral or spiritual authority. The above are familiar scenarios among some of our congregations. However, given the great desire in some of them to become culturally and theologically literate, I have no doubt that in time they will conquer their fears and will grow to accept and even enjoy all kinds of worship experiences offered to them. Shattered Dreams is another gem of a sermon in which King provides example after example of people throughout history who were able to overcome all kinds of disabilities, disappointments, and frustrations. King reflects, some of us, of course, will die without having received the realization of freedom, but we must continue to sail on our charted course. And he advises us, we must accept finite disappointment, but must never lose infinite hope. Only in this way we shall live without the fatigue of bitterness and the drain of resentment. When I read these encouraging words, I felt ministered and ready to continue the struggle for internal and external peace and freedom. No matter if we are beaten, hosed down like dirt on the pavement, attacked by menacing dogs, thrown in jail, still hope can open for us the gates of internal freedom. I believe this very, very much. As a prophet, Martin was relentless in criticizing the lukewarm attitude of the Christian and liberal churches as humanity faced the great challenges of communism, war, and poverty. He was adamant against war anywhere, in Vietnam in particular. You remember that. He was against the death penalty. He was critical of communism and secular humanism. He fought with all his might segregation and racism, and he admired science, but warmed against substituting it for God. Martin started his great work as an organizer of the freedom movement when he was in his 20s. Ironically, because his way to liberation was through peaceful resistance, liberals accused him of being too soft with the establishment. And because he called for boycotts and passive resistance to the injustices and ugliness of segregation, he was accused by the conservatives of being too harsh. Even some of the important leaders of the movement turned against him when he wanted to expand the movement from the South to Chicago. Martin wrote in the dedication of his book, in capital letters, to my father and mother, whose deep commitment to the Christian faith and unswerving devotion to its timeless principles had given me an inspiring example of the strength to love. Martin Luther King Jr. drew much of his strength from his deep faith in and love for Christ. It's this faith that sustained him when he was at his most human, ridden with doubt and pain. His faith gave him the spiritual courage to become a visionary political leader and ultimately a martyr. The Reverend Rosemary Bray McNutt wrote that Coretta Scott and Martin Luther King Jr. went to Unitarian churches in Boston and even thought of becoming Unitarians. Do you know that? Not surprising, Martin's words are imbued with liberal Christianity similar to that of our earlier spiritual ancestors. He quoted Ralph Waldo Emerson, Henry David Thoreau, and Theodore Parker, great Unitarian transcendentalists. He even adopted the arc of the universe is long, but it bends toward justice from Parker's longer version, and is now inscribed in the monument in Washington. And these words are like his, but really not his. It was our loss that Coretta and Martin did not join us, but his teachings, his examples, and his amazing prophetic voice and preaching now belong to all of us. Inspired and supported by our Unitarian Universalist faith and united in purpose and strength, let us continue our transformation into a multicultural, loving, peace and justice-making denomination like the beloved community of Dr. King's dream. Amen. Ashe. And blessed.